Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we hear about what happens when being Santa doesn't turn out the way you want. Also, a man who gives away Christmas trees, the roller derby revival, and we talk to the official historian for Rankin Bass Productions, the people behind the holiday classics Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Santa Claus is Coming to Town. We'll have those stories and more this time on Sidetrack. Art can be made from anything, even a medium that's easy to find in alleys and grocery stores. An exhibit called The Exquisite City features nearly 30 tiny city blocks made almost entirely out of cardboard. The show at the Viaduct Theater on Chicago's North Side gives us a glimpse into the artist's mind and into our own lives. Lynette Kalsness has more.
The day before the opening, several artists gather at the Viaduct. They transform the theater into a metropolis in miniature. City blocks spring up all around them. So do telephone poles, water towers, even those giant red lips from the Magicus signs that drivers used to pass on Chicago's expressways. Nate Homchick installs a cardboard diorama with help from Susan Hall.
What do you think, Susan?
Oh, fantastic.
Does that look like a dog park?
You can hear the dogs barking, practically.
These will be the signs.
The exhibit feels like Christmas. It's like walking into a room of gingerbread houses or a Christmas village with fake snow, except this is an urban environment, and it's artistically rendered by about 70 painters, printmakers, and sculptors. Kathleen Judge is the curator.
Having streets to walk down, having buildings higher than you, and some that are much smaller, it makes it just a real space, a place you could actually kind of hang out.
The Exquisite City features two flats and a Wolfie's hot dog stand in ghostly white. There's a high rise that sprouts into a giant tree and a vacant lot with broken glass. There's even a pyramid made of tortilla boxes topped by a replica of the Robert Taylor Holmes.
If people have this kind of transported magical feeling, then I feel like we've done a great job.
Transported to where?
To their mind, to the inner recesses of their child mind.
Judge was inspired by a childhood moment of her own. She remembers going to the Detroit Historical Museum and walking through an exhibit of old-fashioned fake storefronts.
It's the same feeling to me, like I'm being, you know, in another place, a real place that doesn't exist.
What is it? What's in there?
Well, is there an animal? What kind of animal is that?
Hippopotamus.
What do you think he's doing?
Tell me, getting out of a pool.
Sonny Whitaker peers into the windows of a cardboard skyscraper with his mom, Whitney Blakemore. There's a diorama with a different city scene inside each window. It's part of a sister exhibit here called Exquisite Windows.
Here's Tatiana Gant, her cats, lots of cats in an apartment.
This is what they're doing when you're not home.
Yeah.
Kathleen Judge points to another window. There are tiny cans of old style piled up near a man with a knife in his back. Oh, my goodness.
A very insane, intriguing murder mystery drinking night out with wrestlers and a lot of beer.
It's like peeking into someone's apartment building, and that can be deeply satisfying if you're a little voyeuristic.
Because it's created, it's almost like you're seeing more than just someone's house. You're actually seeing into someone's thought process or their mind and their creativity.
The show's modeled after the game, The Exquisite Corpse. Each person draws a section of the body, covers it up, and passes it around until a bizarre figure is revealed. The artist taking part in The Exquisite City didn't know what the others were making. Printmaker Daniel McAdam turned to industrial buildings.
I've always sort of been drawn to the backsides of things, to the functional parts of structures that aren't meant to be seen.
He built an abandoned building and purposely turned it around so you'd focus on a dumpster and fire escapes.
Lots of people sort of train themselves not to see and really miss so much that's fascinating about the city.
Many of the artists normally work in two dimensions, like painter Julie Salzin. She found a unique thrill working in 3D.
You kind of peer in, and everything's in miniature, so you feel like you're hovering above, and you're like Godzilla coming through very gently.
Salzin says working with cardboard was so much fun, she didn't want to stop. It's like playing with Legos as a kid. I'm Lynette Kalsnes.
The show The Exquisite City runs through December 12th at the Viaduct Theater at 3111 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. More information is available at their website, viaducttheater.com. This is Sidetrack. The New York Times has covered a lot of news since its inception in 1851. A collection of their front pages is compiled in a new book called The New York Times, The Complete Front Pages, 1851 to 2008. It's published by Black Dog and Leventhal Publishers of New York. Some choice dates are featured in this rather large book. The rest can be found in the three DVDs that come along with it. Recently, AM580's Jim Meadows talked with Sam Tannenhaus, editor of the New York Times Book Review and The Week in Review. Tannenhaus wrote an essay covering 1929 to 1939 in the New York Times, the complete front pages. Jim Meadows started their conversation off by talking about a copy of the New York Times he keeps in his desk.
It is the New York Times National Edition. The date is September 12th, 2001. The headline, as you might imagine, U.S. attacked, hijacked jets destroy Twin Towers and hit Pentagon in Day of Terror. Well, we all know why that day and that news story are significant to us. It's perhaps a little more difficult to explain why a newspaper front page sums it all up for us. But this front page is one of more than 50,000 New York Times front pages now collected in a book and a DVD ROM set called The New York Times, The Complete Front Pages, 1851 to 2008. It's published by Black Dog and Leventhal Publishers of New York. And Sam Tannenhaus of The New York Times Book Review and Week in Review is one of the people who worked on that collection. Good afternoon, Sam.
Hi, nice to be with you.
And I wanted to ask you, Sam, what do you think is so fascinating about a newspaper front page?
Well, it's a kind of snapshot of the world at that moment, particularly a paper like The Times, which has always had, or for many years has had, an international focus. It is a way of summing up, and of course you can't get everything in, what that moment in time looks like. Now, some of this has changed with the advent of the web, but particularly in the days when people got their newspapers every morning, when there were 6 or 8 or 10 newspapers being published each day in a city like New York, each one kind of offered a competing version of what had happened the day before, and in a way it kind of creates order for us. Even if you've heard about the event, everybody knows, you know, what happened on September 11th. We didn't need the New York Times to tell us, but somehow it frames it and gives it a kind of focus and coherence and helps us make more sense of it.
Now, that's changed over the years, and you can see, I guess, a real difference between the New York Times as it presents the news today compared to the way it did, say, in the early 20th century, and especially compared to the way it did in the 1850s.
It's true. I mean, if you go back and look at it, it almost seems the front page looks like a series of classified ads almost. There are no images at all. There are several short paragraphs with small headlines. It's just columns and columns of type, because in those days, you know, the technology was not nearly so advanced, and the idea was that it was almost a kind of bulletin, the paper. Another interesting thing to see about the Times is that those of us who work here and others to, often think of it as the newspaper of record. For a long time, it really wasn't. It was just one of many newspapers that evolved, discovered its identity over time. And that identity is always changing, and we hope improving. But you're absolutely right. The early New York Times is kind of shocking to look at. You wonder how anybody could get through it.
Now, you wrote an essay for this collection on the New York Times in the front pages from 1929 to 39. Your essay is called Centralizing the Power. You're looking at the Roosevelt years, at the Depression, at the years leading up to World War II. What did you find out about that time just from looking at those New York Times front pages?
Well, there were a number of surprising things. One is that Herbert Hoover, whom we think of as this kind of either villain or dupe or clueless president, actually was doing everything he could. The problem was, or at the very beginning of the Great Depression, he really didn't have a clue what to do, and he kept hoping everything would somehow improve. And what happened is events got away from him, and we've seen this happen with presidents since. It's interesting, when I wrote that essay, it was probably a year and a half ago or something, and no one had any idea that Wall Street would be imploding the way it did now. The other thing that was interesting for me was to see that although Franklin Roosevelt's election in 1932 was this tremendous repudiation of Hoover, and Roosevelt won in the kind of landslide we can scarcely imagine today. You know, we think of Barack Obama's victory in November as being decisive, and it was. He won 53% of the vote, some 365 electoral college votes. Roosevelt won 57.5% of the vote and 42 out of 48 states. So it was a massive landslide. But what was interesting to me was everybody knew it was coming. Because if you look at the returns of the off-year elections, the congressional elections of 1930, which the New York Times covered naturally on its front page, those victories for the Democrats were already seen as presaging a change of power in the White House, very similar to what happened in 2006 when Congress changed hands here. So what you see are kind of predictions. You see patterns in the way politics worked, in the way reputations fluctuated, that are very similar and kind of resonate today.
You talk, you spoke a few moments ago about how the New York Times was just one of several competing presentations of the news with all the other newspapers in New York City. Did the New York Times as a paper have a particular slant or take that you could see on its front page on, say, FDR's New Deal or whether the U.S. should get into the war in Europe?
Great question. The Times, like so many newspapers back then, this may come as a surprise to some listeners, was actually quite conservative. Most of the major newspapers in America were anti-Roosevelt and anti-New Deal on their editorial pages. The daily coverage tended to be more neutral, as it should have been. One of the big distinctions that people quarrel about today is that in the earlier period, the period we're talking about, news coverage was presented in a different way. It was almost a stenographic record. If a president like Roosevelt or Hoover gave a press conference, all the newspaper did essentially was report what he said. Nowadays, you see a kind of interpretation and scene setting. There's a sort of mood and atmosphere to even the regular news reporting that would never have been allowed then. So if you go back and look at the New York Times' front page from that period, you have no sense what its political position might be. But in the overall spectrum of papers, the Times was kind of in the middle. There was a great classic Republican paper, the Herald Tribune, which now exists only as a foreign newspaper published in English, owned by the Times now and published in Paris. The Herald Tribune was the voice of an East Coast Republicanism in that period. And the New York Post, for those of you who are familiar with it and think of it now as a very conservative paper owned by Rupert Murdoch, was then a very liberal publication. There was the New York Daily News, which still exists. That was somewhat more conservative. The Post and News have kind of flopped identities in recent years. And then there were papers people don't even think about that have vanished altogether. Probably the greatest newspaper from that period was the New York World, which was edited by Walter Lippmann, who was the premier journalist and pundit of that era. That was a greater newspaper in the 30s than the New York Times.
If this book is, say, updated 20 years from now with another 20 years of New York Times front pages, what role do you imagine a newspaper front page will be playing by that time, considering the advent of the Internet
and TV? I thought about that a lot because we, at the Times, now have roughly as many online readers as we do newsprint readers. And you know yourself, I'm sure you're a journalist, and many of your listeners know this too, there is no fixed front page online. It's changing constantly. So I don't know, actually, how you capture that. In the course of a 24-hour cycle, the New York Times' front page may go through half a dozen different iterations as news, not only as news is reported, news stories come in, but the location, the placement of stories is changing constantly. So I really don't know what it would look like. You might not be able to do it in this form, is my guess. Now, we still think here at the paper, I'm sure all newspapers do, that the print edition we publish for the next morning is the kind of final draft of what we've put together. But the fact is, the majority of readers may have looked at some earlier draft, so there's not the same one-to-one correspondence between what all those millions of people have read and what we would have on the print edition at a particular moment. Even after September 11th, you know, you are very wise to choose the September 12th headline. That even feels as if it comes from a period when the print edition of the newspaper was set in a kind of stone. That simply doesn't exist anymore.
Well, these front pages still exist in this book and DVD-ROM set, The New York Times, The Complete Front Pages, 1851 to 2008. It's a very big book with three DVD-ROMs. And Sam Tannenhaus, one of the people who worked on it, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Jim.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. A sport that was popular several decades ago is experiencing a renaissance. New roller derby leagues are popping up all over the country. The sounds of roller skates, whistles, wipeouts, and yelling can be heard from many rinks in upstate New York. Independent producer Jasmine Belcher explains.
Are you ready for some?
I'm at my very first women's roller derby bout in Ithaca, New York. Today, the Ithaca Suffragettes take on the Hellions of Troy from the Albany area, and I have no idea what to expect. All I know is that the only thing keeping me from certain death is this narrow piece of green tape, which is meant to separate the very pushy skaters who whiz by on a flat track from the huge screaming crowd. Each team consists of over a dozen skaters, with most of them sporting fishnet stockings, checkered, striped, and argyle knee highs and red lipstick. Skin not covered by elbow pads, wrist guards, or knee pads shows off brightly colored tattoos. Helmets are covered with stickers, and the wheels on their roller skates range from black to hot pink, giving off some sort of a punk or rockabilly aesthetic for sure. These girls look tough. Tough enough to intimidate at least one unsuspecting onlooker.
Oh my word, look at this lot. That looks very hard. You wouldn't want to meet any of these on a dark night, would you?
That's David Dobson.
That's David with a T. I'm a very unusual man. I'm not totally British, but yeah. I've come all the way just to watch this match today.
Well, that's not really true, but he says he saw a sign for the bout outside the Cass Park rink in Ithaca, and it intrigued him. He admits he knows nothing about roller derby, other than it was popular several decades ago and there were a few movies on the sport. Another thing that fascinated him were the skaters' aliases.
Oh, that's Detrimental Diva.
Muffy Slayer.
Whoa, what a great name that is.
Starbucks, Scarbucks. Shockratties. Now, that's clever. Look, Shockratties. Dora the Explorer. I saw her go round. She's large. She's very large. And in charge.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want her to charge me, my God.
She started as a me. Who does she think she is? Don't you know who I am?
Okay, so what's roller derby? How's it played? Johanna Bolos, who goes by Princess Impaler, skates for the Suffragettes and for Syracuse's Assault City Roller Derby League. She explains the sport.
There are five people per team on the track at a time. Each team has a jammer, and the jammer is the person that scores the points. The other eight people, four from each team, make up what's called the pack. The pack will be skating around, and then they will blow another whistle, and the jammer will go. The jammer's job is to try and get through the pack. So I'm trying to stop the other team's jammer, and I'm trying to help my jammer. And once my jammer makes it through, the next time she comes back and makes it through, she scores points for every person she passes. You have to pass legally, though. Like, you can't be out of bounds when you pass. You can't chicken wing, which is like, you know, putting your arms up and hitting people. You can't do stuff like that.
Princess says back in the day, roller derby was much different.
I know that back in either the 60s or the 70s, they would have the bank track, where it was actually on like a banked track, and there would be fighting. It was kind of like the WWE. It was very scripted, fake fights.
Watch that rail now as they're getting closer to that rail. Look out!
They sure take their roller derby seriously. Oh well, girls will be girls.
I believe back in 2005 there was a rebirth with the flat track, which is what we do. There's about 50 WIFTA leagues, and WIFTA is the Women's Flat Track Derby Alliance, and about 300 teams that are not WIFTA but that would like to be. Like, we're not WIFTA. It takes a couple years to get accepted into that. If you are in WIFTA, there's championships, there's playoffs, all that kind of stuff.
So what does it take to be a derby girl? Well, I stopped by an Assault City roller derby practice and got a sense of how much work this sport really is.
Switch! Other way.
The grassroots Syracuse League was formed in December 2006. Each girl chips in to pay for the practice space. On this day, a guest coach came from Massachusetts to give the girls a few pointers. Drew Spring goes by Calico Jack when on the track.
It's still a new growing sport. We want to support as many new leagues as we can.
He's been skating for about 4 years.
I knew nothing about it when I got recruited. I showed up for a practice, and I've missed like two practices in the 4 years since, and it's just completely taken over my life.
Calico Jack admits that when it comes to roller derby, it's kind of a woman's world.
We were the first men's league in the country, and we actually encountered a lot of opposition to it when we first did it. A lot of the leagues, I won't name any of them, but were opposed to us trying to steal their sport, as they put it. But that's kind of passed, and now we get a lot of support from all the area leagues. Our league in particular is actually a co-ed league.
And the men don't wear fishnets, do they?
There are some that do. There's even a couple that wear miniskirts.
He says there's about 7 men's leagues in the U.S. That's compared to over 300 women's leagues. But no matter what your gender, the sport is certainly not for the faint of heart.
I broke a rib. I dislocated my left knee. I sprained my right ankle. And I dislocated my radial on my right arm.
And again, Princess Impaler.
We had 4 broken ankles in 4 months. We had a cracked tailbone, a torn ACL. Oh, someone fell and hit their chin and had stitches on their chin. So, I mean, it's very dangerous. It's not really if you're going to get hurt, it's when.
But according to Princess, the bruises fade and the bones heal. And that's nothing compared to the sense of empowerment she gets from skating.
I've played sports my whole life, and this is the only sport where I put makeup on to go to practice, or like care what I look like. And it's not just about the sport. I mean, when you're on the track, it's 100% sport. But when you're off, there's, you get to be another person. You get to dress up and look cute. And I definitely leave practice and just feel like, yes, look what I did. And I don't know, it's just cool.
And anyone can join, whether you're a stay-at-home mom or a mechanic. All shapes and all sizes are welcome. And who knows, maybe your neighbor skates in their free time, or your boss goes by an alias after work. If you're looking for a more extreme workout, or maybe a new way to get your aggression out, chances are there's a roller derby league near you, or at least a bout you could attend. Either way, one thing's for sure, after you leave that rink, you'll never know what hit you. In Oswego, New York, I'm Jasmine Belcher.
You're listening to Sidetrack. When reporter Sean Hurley heard that one of his New Hampshire neighbors was giving away Christmas trees, he wanted to find out more about this charitable act. And what he found was that this man's very public act, letting people wander over his property to pick out and cut down one of his Christmas trees, was also very private.
When I first spoke to Harry on the phone, I could tell he wasn't entirely comfortable with the idea of my coming to do a story on the way he celebrates Christmas. "I don't want to be set up on a pedestal," he said. But after assuring him on the phone that there'd be no pedestals and no heroes, he reluctantly agreed to meet with me. So upon arriving, I wasn't too surprised to hear that he'd had second thoughts.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, how you doing?
Good. Did you get my message?
Oh, no, I didn't.
Yeah, I said I wasn't interested.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, not a problem. I thought it was someone coming to get a tree. Yeah. I was just coming out to help him.
I wasn't sure if the interview was over, as Harry explained his misgivings.
I don't need any limelight.
Right.
I'm an easygoing guy.
Right.
And secondly, I don't want to have 20 people coming up here that are freeloaders.
Harry's secret forest of beautiful Christmas trees will not be made available to the public at large. But then, who are the trees for?
The trees I give away are to mostly single working moms and people that can't afford a tree, and that's what I do.
Harry spreads the word about his trees by means of a little sheet that he distributes to the local pubs and tavern.
So I basically tell anyone that is employed there, if they want to come get a tree, they can. They don't hang it on a wall, because I ask them not to, because I don't want just everybody coming up and getting trees.
Harry lives right on the edge of the wilderness. Behind his yard is the old-fashioned world of mountains and rivers and trees. There's about a foot of snow, and it's very cold, maybe 10 degrees, as we walk the 50 yards or so to the stand of Christmas trees. They're set out on the open expanse to one side of the house.
So now how many people have you had come out to cut down trees so far?
I think probably about 15 people have been here already this year. And I had 100 trees, and it's dwindling down. What I want to do is get rid of all of them so I can plant some more trees.
And what kind of trees are these?
Mostly balsam firs.
Yeah.
It's a regular Christmas tree. There's a few spruce in here. They're all around, I'm going to say 8 years, 9 years. They grow about a foot a year.
Does that mean the taller ones are getting a little more light, or just...
I don't know what it is. But what's interesting is people like small ones.
Harry brushes snow from the limbs of a small tree and jounces its plumage to show it in its best light. It's striking and strange that these trees are of such wildly different heights and vitality. And they're all about the same age. Some are 2 foot tall and waiting for Charlie Brown to show up and have pity. Other 10-foot beauties show off their perfect isosceles shape and density. It should be said here that Harry isn't specifically Christmassy in his charity. He gives food away, too. As I arrived, he was working on some sourdough bread to be taken down later to some women in town. In the summer, too, Harry has several gardens, and though he harvests for himself, there's plenty left over.
In the summer, I give a lot of food away, and then I get to a point where I just back my truck up, open the back up, and I have bags there, and I'll say, hey, there's a free market out there. Mostly the women go running out,
because right.
They know the value more than some single guy sitting there drinking
That's
a beer.
That's true, you know? We don't know what's going on. What, some bread? I don't need any bread.
Yeah, right.
I had seen a sheet of paper taped to the garage door and a box of some kind on the driveway, and I asked Harry about these.
I have a saw down here with twine and scissors. And it basically just says, go cut a tree and please bring the saw back for the next family and Merry Christmas.
As we walk back down to the house, Harry makes it clear that he gets something from his giving.
I had some lady, didn't even know her, and she came down to the bar the other day, and she said, I really appreciate what you did. She said, I wouldn't have a tree otherwise. So that made me feel good.
Really good.
And that's all there is to it, I think. That's enough for Harry, which is why he's so reticent about my doing a story about him, about this, because nothing else need be added here. The circle of giving and receiving is complete, without any need for observation. And in a way, I think Harry is letting me do this story for me. I didn't come here needing a tree. I came here needing a story, and that's what he gave me. Thank you, Harry, and Merry Christmas. I'm Sean Hurley.
still to come, what happens when you try to play Santa and it turns out wrong. And we talk to the historian for Rankin Bass Productions, the people behind the holiday classic Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Stay tuned. For many people, the holidays are a time for reflection on how much they have and remembering those who are less fortunate. The father of reporter Scott Gurian likes to think of himself as a charitable person, but last Christmas, he got a bit more than he bargained for. Scott has this story.
Christmas time doesn't really mean much to my dad. He lives alone, most of his family is out of state, and anyway, he's Jewish. So a few years ago, he got to thinking.
Even though Christmas isn't my holiday per se, rather than just sit around and do nothing, I might as well give back and do some good for people that would like to celebrate it, but they don't have the means to celebrate it.
So he started volunteering at a soup kitchen. He collected donations of winter clothing from his neighbors to give out to the homeless.
And the other thing I do is I go to the post office. They always have letters for Santa Claus, and people could answer them if they want. I pick out the ones that are really the saddest, kids that are writing letters and they're asking for clothes, they're asking for shoes, and they say, "And Santa, if you have anything left in your bag, can you maybe get me a shirt?"
My dad usually takes about a dozen or so letters, passes a bunch out to his friends, and keeps a few for himself. Last year, he answered three from kids in the Bronx.
I went to like a discount store and I try to comply with most of the things on the list. I went to FedEx, I shipped it, and for whatever reason, I put my cell phone number in there, not so much to get a thank you, but just because I wanted to know, I guess, that the packages got there.
Did you write Santa Claus on the return address?
Yes, I did.
And so you shipped it off, and did you kind of think that would be the end of it?
I kind of did, yeah.
It wasn't long before the calls started rolling in.
4:43 p.m.
Hello?
This is Rosicella.
Thank you, I love you.
Thank you for the presents you gave me. I love you. Bye.
Do you remember how you felt when you first started getting these voicemails?
Yeah, I thought that was really nice. It made me feel good that they were happy.
But it didn't stop there.
No, it didn't. It was kind of funny in a way. It went from thank you to kind of almost desperate, menacing phone calls, and the calls were getting more and more frequent.
Can I have a few presents because my mother is broke and I have no presents? Thank you. I love you. Bye. Even though you didn't get me no presents, I still love you. Bye, Santa.
What are your thoughts hearing this again now?
I think they were bringing some of the kids in from outside from the neighborhood because they heard that Santa Claus came.
Was there a point where you started to regret, you know, what you had intended as a charitable act?
I think at some point I regretted putting my phone number down because this one kid was getting more aggressive and more ferocious. I was getting calls like every half hour, every hour.
Santa! Santa! Come on, Santa!
Were you purposely avoiding their calls?
Absolutely. I wasn't going to pick up.
Why?
I think I would have encouraged them more if they would have called. Then they would have asked for many more presents. And after all, Santa Claus only delivers at night. The kids are not supposed to speak directly to Santa Claus. At least when I grew up.
Did this whole experience make you feel any different about being charitable?
Well, while there might be some people that could be scamming Santa Claus, you do it with the idea that
hopefully the majority of the people that write these letters are legit and honest, and that's the best way to approach it.
Bye, Ron DeGaria. I'm Santa Claus.
My dad's decided to play Santa again this year. Last I spoke to him, he had picked three kids' names and was just heading out the door, trying to decide what to get.
That story from Sean Hurley. You're listening to Sidetrack. At Christmas, independent producer Susan Kotler's public school kindergarten class performed the story of the birth of Christ, complete with New Testament readings, pint-sized Mary and Joseph, and refreshments delivered by Santa himself. Christmas was a really big deal in the small town Kotler grew up in, but she feels such a spectacle would be unthinkable in our current politically correct era. Back then, it was the high point of her young life.
The Madonna, shepherds, the Christ child himself, all in my public school classroom. Yes, we had a kindergarten Christmas pageant, and it even included the New Testament. Back then, in the rural USA, it didn't matter whether you were Christian or not, since no one thought they knew anyone who wasn't. So our teacher, Miss Bird, organized us to act out the nativity while she read the narrative from the Bible. Mothers came with younger siblings and sat on child-sized chairs to watch our politically incorrect drama. Miss Bird chose Chucky to be Joseph. Mary Lou was Mary, which seemed fair, since she had the right name. The Christ child was played by a rubber baby doll. Many of us, draped in swaths of fabric, were shepherds. The play began with Chucky and Mary Lou journeying from the far corner of the kindergarten classroom while Miss Bird read, "And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed." We didn't know what that meant, but we were excited. The room was darkened and strategically lighted. Our moms were there, and refreshments were promised. Mary Lou and Chucky then passed by the shepherds assembled on top of the toy cupboards. When the holy couple arrived at the makeshift inn, Chucky was supposed to ask a classmate, "Is there room at the inn?" Instead, he said, "Hey, you got any rooms?" The mothers laughed. Since there was no vacancy, he and Mary Lou made their way to a small enclosure with hay strewn about and maybe a hobby horse or two standing by. As Miss Bird read, "And she brought forth her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling cloths and laid him in a manger," somehow the rubber baby appeared, which made as much sense as anything else we knew about where babies came from. After the holy birth, Nancy Smith got to be an angel, standing apart from the shepherds on the toy cupboard. She had a pretty drape of fabric, white wings, and a metal halo, and she had a line, "Fear not, for unto you is born this day a Savior." I didn't understand why I couldn't say it. I was jealous of Nancy Smith, and thus was born my lifelong unrequited love of acting. Not that I didn't have my moment. Just before the three kindergarten wise men strode over to the manger to adore the newborn, I slipped from my perch on the toy cupboard to the back of the scene where a dad had rigged up a light with a cord. When Miss Bird read, "And the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it came to rest over the place where the child was," I pulled the cord and the Star of Bethlehem shone brightly. After the play, we sang Away in a Manger. Then Miss Bird exclaimed,
Boys and girls, I have a surprise. Santa Claus just flew over and dropped off some Dixie cups for us. I was skeptical that Santa would leave the North Pole just to deliver ice cream during his busy season. Later, my dad picked us up on his way home from work for lunch. My mother told him I had done a great job with the Star of Bethlehem.
That feature from independent producer Susan Kotler. You're tuned to Sidetrack. Christmas just wouldn't be Christmas without certain movies and TV shows. Think It's a Wonderful Life, A Christmas Story, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, A Charlie Brown Christmas, and of course the 1964 classic Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. That last show was produced by Arthur Rankin Jr. and Jules Bass, the same folks who created a slew of other holiday specials, including Santa Claus is Coming to Town, Frosty the Snowman, and The Year Without a Santa Claus. Rick Goldschmidt is a biographer and official historian for Rankin Bass Productions. He has written extensively about Rankin Bass and has just released the third printing of his book, The Enchanted World of Rankin Bass. He also blogs about them at enchantedworldofrankinbass.blogspot.com. I talked with Goldschmidt recently and asked him why he thinks these shows have stood the test of time.
Well, there's a lot of reasons, and that's why I had to write a book about it. Actually, my second book, The Making of Rankin Bass's holiday classic, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, goes into how the show was made up. And it worked on so many different levels, but the core of the whole thing and all of their specials is the writing has to be really good. And Romeo Muller wrote these shows, and he wrote them in such a way that they're timeless. And there's a lot of heart and warmth in these things that doesn't exist in today's entertainment, except if for the Pixar films. They know writing is the key, and that's where their focus is. They don't go for the cheap, you know, farting jokes that you see in a Shrek or, you know, something like that. So that's really the heart of the matter is the heart. And that's why they've lasted so long.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the creators of these shows, Arthur Rankin Jr. and Jules Bass?
Well, Arthur Rankin met Jules Bass back in the 50s when he was the art director at ABC. Jules was working for an advertising agency and was also a jingle writer, and they decided to match their talents and start a company called Videocraft International. And back in the early days when they started this company, they were financing their projects themselves, taking out loans from the bank, and they produced this series called The New Adventures of Pinocchio and The Tales of the Wizard of Oz. And it wasn't until 1964 that they really found what they needed to do with their company, and that was make television, holiday television specials like Rudolph. And once Rudolph became a huge success because it was the highest rated Christmas special ever, they just continued on doing these specials, and they did some 36 television specials. They've also done, you know, a dozen feature films and a lot of TV series like the Jackson 5 show and the Osmond show and King Kong and a whole bunch of different things. So they branched out, and
In 64, the General Electric Company financed everything and started an entertainment division called Tomorrow Entertainment, and that really is what financed all of Arthur Rankin and Jewel's projects.
Talk a little bit about the production process in making Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. This was all stop-motion photography, correct?
Right. The way it worked is, and to put it in a nutshell, they created the show in New York. Romeo Muller was a writer in New York. Maury Laws wrote the music. Arthur had some designers like Paul Coker and Jack Davis who worked for Mad Magazine. They were in New York back then. So all of the, and Don Duga would do the storyboards. So all of these guys were New Yorkers, and they would send the animation out to Japan where they would do this stop motion. And Arthur Rankin knew the Japanese culture and oversaw the production in Japan and got the top talents in animation in Japan to work on this stuff. A guy named Tad Moshinaga is considered to be the father of stop motion in Japan, so he was like at the head of the team. And then the voice actors, for the most part, especially on the early stuff like Rudolph and Willie McBean and his Magic Machine and a bunch of other things they did back then, were in Canada. And they did that because in Canada, the union was agreeable to a two-year buyout, which saved Rankin-Bass money. And it was not only an economic thing, but it was also that they were super talented in Canada. Radio went on longer in Canada than it did in the States. They did a lot of old-time radio type things. So all of these voice actors were right out of radio and super talented people, and that's why the voices in Rudolph are so distinct. And that's kind of how it works. So it was a Canadian, Japanese, New York thing. And when you look at it, it looks totally American, but you know, the Japanese had a lot to do with the way that animation looked.
Well, I did want to talk about the design of the characters and the scenes, because when you look at it, there's something very old-fashioned about how the characters are designed and the settings, but there's also something very mod about it, very 1960s, you know,
right,
pop art. Talk a little bit about how that all came together. You talked about Jack Davis, an illustrator for Mad Magazine, working on these. Where did they get their inspiration for the design work for all this?
Well, I will say this. If Arthur Rankin and I have one thing in common, it's the love of good art, and that continues to today. I'm an illustrator. My degree's in illustration, and he knew talent immediately as far as who he needed and wanted for these shows. And he had a guy named Tony Peters who did that early mod-looking stuff, and that's some of my favorite stuff, is the early kind of UPA, real simplistic, stylish stuff. And that's where they got that mod look. He was a New York illustrator. And then when he branched out with Paul Coker, he had a very distinctive style. And that translated over to the animation, especially in Frosty and with the Heat Miser and Snow Miser, and some of his Santa Claus designs are very unique. Paul Coker is almost the quintessential Rankin-Bass illustrator. And then Jack Davis is my favorite illustrator, and I think he's Arthur Rankin's too. And he had a whole different look to his art, and they use that quite well in Mad Monster Party, which is my second favorite Rankin-Bass show.
And so that's a Halloween show.
Yeah, it's a feature film, actually, and it's an amazing DVD, the quality of it, and I did a book that's in the DVD. It's an amazing project. It inspired Tim Burton to do, you know, Nightmare Before Christmas and The Corpse Bride, and all the stuff that he does is kind of out of Mad Monster Party, and it's very influential. And some other illustrators Arthur Rankin used was Al Hirschfeld, you know, the famous Broadway cartoonist. He used him in The Daydreamer, which was another feature film they did. And then this other artist for Mad Comedians, Stark, Bruce Stark. He was a very stylish cartoonist from that era. So, I mean, he chose nothing but the best artists to do these cartoony type things, and that's why they look so good.
Well, we talked about the Halloween, the monster show, and of course the Christmas shows, but they did other holiday themed specials as well. Some that you might not expect.
Right.
So tell us about a couple of the other Rankin Bass holiday specials.
Well, The Little Drummer Boy is one of their great ones, and The Little Drummer Boy Book 2, I think that won an Emmy, or at least it was nominated for one. And that is a, you know, ties in religion and what the holiday's all about. So that's a special, you know, Rankin Bass show. Another favorite of the fans is Nestor the Long-Eared Donkey, which is kind of reminiscent of Bambi, but Romeo Muller really wrote some nice things in that one, and they actually won a Peabody for a show that wasn't a holiday special, and that's The Hobbit. And then they did Return of the King, too, which somewhat inspired the movie makers of all of those Lord of the Rings films that were so big a few years back. So they've had quite an influence on the entertainment world. And really, if you look at my first book, nothing that they did was weak, you know. Nothing was a throwaway kind of project. They always put quality into what they did, and they never really lost that quality through all of those holiday specials. And that's why, you know, ABC Family runs them all month long, and it's basically the Rankin Bass channel, you know.
Well, a couple of years ago, the actual puppets for Santa and Rudolph were found in an attic, and they were in bad shape. Tell us a little bit about that story and the status of the puppets today.
Right. I actually put some of the pictures of the restored puppets in my third printing of my first book, The Enchanted World of Rankin Bass, which I'm getting out now myself in a hardcover. And the puppets we had on tour with us for the last two or three years, and the way they were found was one of Arthur Rankin's secretaries actually took home the Rudolph cast of puppets and used them at Christmas time as part of their family decorations and kept them in an attic, and the only two that survived were Santa and Rudolph. And those are the two best to survive, although I'd like to see all of them. If any two were going to survive it, it's great that those two did. And they were purchased in auction and then restored by Time and Space Toys and Screen Novelties out in Hollywood. And Screen Novelties, I'm friends with those guys. They do Robot Chicken, and they did this Ray Harryhausen short that was not finished years ago that completely blew me away, called Tortoise and the Hare. It looked like it was from the 1940s, but it was new. And I knew they could restore Santa and Rudolph, so they did. And we brought them out to various places the last couple of years so all the fans could see them and enjoy them. And it's been a really, really neat neat side project of everything that I do.
Your book, The Enchanted World of Rankin Bass, is going to be in its third printing here soon. but you are also the official historian for Rankin Bass. How does one get that gig?
Well, when I started this whole thing, I did it out of love of their shows because there was nothing available about who Arthur Rankin and Jules Bass were. So that's why I did it. And being an illustrator, I was able to lay out a really neat book. And I did a lot of the illustrations myself. And that was all I thought I was going to be doing, you know, was doing a book and then continuing with my illustration work. But all of a sudden, there came all these products from my book. I had mentioned in the book with all the merchandising that they really didn't do any Rudolph and they really didn't do any Frosty stuff, and they should do it. So I got a call from CVS and Stuffins, this company that was making beanie bag dolls, and it just exploded from there. I mean, the interest in Rankin Bass went up, you know, 1,000%, and every year I have been doing various things that I never thought I'd be doing and I never thought I'd be talking about, and that includes, you know, radio interviews, TV, book signings, DVD, producing DVDs and CDs, and designing figurines for Inesco. I did a lot of that just after my first book, and I helped with some of the action figures, and that's how I became the historian, because there was no one there to do that. There was no one saving the history of Rankin Bass, and the stuff was getting thrown away and not talked about for, you know, some 20 years until I came along. So it's been interesting. It's a fun thing to do, and I'm so happy to be associated with it because it's such a wholesome, great quality thing. And then I'm able to give credit to these guys who deserve credit that no one else would have given credit to.
Well, if people want to learn more about Rankin Bass and all the great shows they did, or you have a blog as well, I hear. So if people want to look at this stuff online, where should they go?
Well, I update my blog every day, so that's the best place to go, and that's enchantedworldofrankinbass.blogspot.com, or you can get there from rankinbass.com and just click on the news, most recent news.
That was Rick Goldschmidt, official historian and biographer for Rankin Bass Productions. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. All the past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL Urbana.